Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 31st of August, these are our main stories. We hear from South Africa, where more than 70 people have died in a building fire in central Johannesburg.
It is a sad day indeed. There's a high chance that the numbers might still increase.
And after Hurricane Idalia, we look at the huge clear-up that lies ahead. Also in this podcast, there are further signs that the Chinese economy is continuing to struggle. And we find out how a team of online love scammers was brought down in Indonesia. A fire that raged through a five-storey building in central Johannesburg in South Africa has left more than 70 people dead. The loss of life, though, seems to have been made much worse because residents couldn't get through a locked gate. Kenny Bupe saw what happened.
The actual fire escape was closed. There was a lot of people, you know, a lot of people were smoke, people were suffocated. A lot of people died because of the smoke, because there was a lot of pressure at the gates. Some of the gates were closed.
This was a building that had been taken over or hijacked by gangs and then rented out to hundreds of people, most of them homeless migrants. Lebogang Maile is a housing official for the city.
This is a tragedy of monumental proportions, and it's unfortunate that today we are here. And this for us demonstrates a chronic problem of housing in our province. As we've previously said, that there's at least 1.2 million people who need housing in our province.
Phumza Philani, our correspondent in Johannesburg, told me the latest.
The authorities have been at pains to explain why even such a building exists and why so many people were left to live in such conditions. It's been described here as a hijacked building, which basically means it's a building that was condemned by its owners and declared unsafe. But what has subsequently happened is that it's understood it was taken over by so-called property cartels that are said to be operating in the city centre, and they've been then renting it out to scores of people per room, charging sometimes exorbitant amounts for a very small-sized room and often cramming as much as 10 people in a room that's only big enough to host two people. And this then makes helps you understand why it's been difficult for the rescue or even recovery mission to go ahead at speed. Because authorities have told us that when they got into the building, they found shack-like partitions inside the building, sometimes even in the basement, making movement very difficult. So you can imagine that when this fire started at around 1:30 in the morning, a lot of people would have woken up and tried to run to the nearest exit and struggled to get out from those various exits. It's also created questions then around what the housing crisis that has been seen in cities like Johannesburg, which often attract economic migrants from neighbouring countries, but also people from poorer parts of South Africa, and how when they get to Johannesburg, they are often left to sort of find accommodation in such buildings and without any monitoring from the authorities. So it's creating some really difficult questions for the authorities to answer, but also for the families who have fallen victim to this, who want answers and who want help, but also want to know what is to happen to them now.
That was Phumza Philani. To Gabon now, where the new transitional leader, General Brice Oligui Nguema, has defended the move to oust the country's long-standing leader and take power. Wednesday's military coup saw the removal of President Ali Bongo, who, along with his father, had ruled the African state for more than half a century. Camille Epembia is an entrepreneur and independent politician. Speaking to the BBC, he expressed hope that General Nguema's rule would be a stepping stone to a more democratic country.
We believe things should be done step by step. The first step was removing the Bongo family and the political party who've been there for almost 60 years. If he's a military guy close to them, we don't mind. We are just concerned about the fact he's a military because we don't want him to stay there forever. If he can help in transitioning to a real democratic leader, we up with him.
Well, in an interview with the French newspaper Le Monde, General Ngaima has been outlining why his team of officers toppled the country's long-standing president and what comes next. I asked our correspondent Myoni Jones, who's following the story, to tell us more about what he's been saying.
He's been outlining the reasons for taking over the country, mainly that, they did it because they felt that Saturday's elections were unconstitutional, that they weren't the will of the people, and that it was time for the country to have new leadership. Gabon's been under the control of the same family for over 50 years now, and for a lot of Gabonese people, it's meant that the country's huge oil wealth, the resources that comes from its substantial forest, about 90% of its territory is covered by forestry, that hasn't trickled down to them, and that's led to a lot of unhappiness. And I think that that's why when the coup was announced yesterday, we saw the scenes that were released on social media of kind of huge crowds coming out into the streets of the capital, Libreville, and celebrating. But I think, as usual with these coups, it's important to remember that they're not necessarily, as much as they might immediately have popular support, they're not necessarily a reflection of kind of popular uprising. This was a military takeover by a small group of armed officers, you know, that were part of the Republican Guard, this elite unit that was meant to be protecting the president. They've decided to take over. And as much as they may be saying that they're here to kind of implement the will of the people, nothing's guaranteed in the future. Whether they will hand over to a civilian government is not known yet.
Myoni, there has been growing international condemnation of Wednesday's coup. But what's the latest on the ground in Gabon? Is there any likelihood that this will be overturned?
I think people are kind of waiting now to see what this transitional government is going to do next, whether they'll appoint some sort of civilian figurehead, as we've seen in Niger and other countries, or whether Mr. Ngaima is going to be in charge of things temporarily. How long will the transition period last? You know, in Niger, the junta there says it wants to be in place for 3 years. The Algerian government has been trying to broker negotiations, says it should be 6 months. So the length of the transition period and what role Mr. Ngaima plays in the government, I think, will be instrumental in knowing what direction this junta wants to go in.
Myoni Jones. Hours after Hurricane Idalia slammed into the west coast of Florida, authorities were still trying to assess the full extent of damage in the hardest hit areas. The Category 3 hurricane, with winds of up to 125 miles an hour, that's over 200 kilometres an hour, raged through low-lying towns of Florida's Big Bend area before making its way inland and onto the state of Georgia. Our North America correspondent John Sudworth reports from Florida.
Brent Burzett and David Hickman are mopping out their home.
Watermark's right there.
But this is the first time you've had a flood like this?
Yeah.
Idalia has turned the deep pile carpet in their front room into something resembling a swampy marsh.
We went out on one of the boats because there was... I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 inches of water in the house.
They were right in the way when, as predicted, the hurricane brought with it a storm surge, pushing the waters from the Gulf of Mexico onto low-lying communities like theirs.
There is this talk about this increased risk of these sorts of adverse weather events. Does it make you think twice about living so close to the ocean?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, because what used to be, you know, late September hurricane is now
late August
hurricane, and they just seem to be getting worse.
And summers are getting hotter, yeah.
So,
while many people did heed the warnings to get out of the way of the storm, many chose to stay, to the frustration of firefighters like Chief Tony Perez from Florida's Pasco County.
We do heed the warning. We do tell people it's a mandatory evacuation, but at the end of the day, they're going to choose, hopefully, to leave, but unfortunately, people have their lifelong belongings in there. They don't want to lose anything, so they rather weather through that storm. So hopefully this is another indication moving forward that people, when we say mandatory evacuation, please evacuate.
But it is the reality. Many will put themselves in harm's way to protect their property, especially those whose homes are uninsured. The vulnerability of this coastline, some of those I've spoken to here tell me, simply makes cover too expensive. And in the wake of this hurricane, there will once again be questions about the wisdom of continuing to develop towns and communities in places like this, as well as the cost of protecting them. President Joe Biden, while promising to provide all the support Florida needs, spoke of the growing frequency of adverse weather events.
I don't think anybody can deny the impact of the climate crisis anymore. Just look around. Historic floods. I mean, historic floods. More intense droughts. Extreme heat, significant wildfires have caused significant damage like we've never seen before.
Warmer sea temperatures are giving these storms more power, and weakening winds in the Earth's high atmosphere cause them to travel more slowly, making the damage more prolonged. Even while some residents here are still recovering from last year's Hurricane Ian, many are left wondering what the next one will have in store.
John Sudworth. The world's second largest economy, China, continues to show signs of decline, with the property, manufacturing, retail and service sectors all struggling. The latest manufacturing figures showed a fifth straight month of decline. Our Asia business correspondent Nick Marsh reports.
Another month, another set of worrying figures in China. This time round, the numbers were fractionally better than expected, but ultimately they still show that demand for Chinese goods from abroad is poor. And for an economy that relies on exports, that's not good news. But there are deeper problems still. Since lifting tough zero COVID restrictions at the end of last year, China's seen record low economic growth, record youth unemployment, and falling prices. Worse still, the country's housing market, which used to be worth a third of China's entire wealth, has collapsed. It's made households poorer, and the post-pandemic spending boom, seen in most of the rest of the world, hasn't materialised.
Nick Marsh. ABBA's singer Agnetha Fältskog has released her first new record in 10 years in the form of a solo song called Where Do We Go From Here? Well, the track was premiered by our colleagues on BBC Domestic Radio this morning and is the first release from Agnetha's forthcoming album A+. Our music correspondent Mark Savage reports.
As the lead vocalist on hits such as Voulez-Vous, Chiquitita and The Winner Takes It All, Agnetha Fältskog is one of the most recognisable voices in pop. But when she was offered a new song last year, the 73-year-old worried about her ability to perform.
It was a girl singing it in the demo, and I thought I would never do it. We didn't know about the voice, if it was there. It's the same with talking English, because I talk Swedish all the time at home, so I feel a little rusty right now.
She was persuaded to give the song a go by the producer Jörgen Ellefsen, who previously put together her 2013 album A. And despite her concerns, that clear, yearning soprano is instantly recognisable. Where Do We Go From Here premiered on BBC Radio 2 this morning, and Agnetha said the thrill of releasing new music hadn't faded 55 years after her debut single.
You never get tired of it, to hear yourself on the radio. That's really something. It's always a tensed feeling, you can say, about what are the people going to think about this. Because I'm not so young anymore, and I'm very grateful that I still have my voice.
The song is out today, with the album A+, coming in October.
Mark Savage. Still to come on the podcast.
War mobilizes us and unites us. We are ready for victory.
I feel worrying about future. I hope that the war will be stopped.
As the drone attacks continue on Moscow and other parts of Russia, we assess the public mood. The week after next marks 50 years since General Augusto Pinochet seized power in Chile, the beginning of a brutal dictatorship which saw thousands of his supposed enemies executed, tortured, or simply disappeared. On Wednesday, the Chilean authorities announced a special commission to try to find the more than 1,000 people who are still missing. Announcing the project called Truth and Justice, President Gabriel Boric said Chile had a historic responsibility to find answers.
With this policy, we're taking responsibility, both as a government and as a country, to do everything we can to find the disappeared. That will hopefully contradict those who say it's simply too difficult to find out exactly what did happen to all those who were forcibly disappeared.
For more details about those missing people, my colleague Oliver Conway spoke to Paula Molina, a freelance radio host based in the Chilean capital, Santiago.
Under the military regime in Chile, which lasts since 1973, there were more than 1,000 people who disappeared, and their relatives never find their remains. It's been 50 years since then, and it's been a very painful reality for so many Chilean families. They've been waiting for all these 5 decades. They've been doing all their efforts to find their relatives, to find some remains, but they've been most on their own, basically. Chilean justice has not been able to deal with all these cases. There is a pact of silence which doesn't allow people to get information about what happened to their loved ones. 96% of those disappeared were men. Half of them were people from the countryside. Half of them didn't have any. They were not affiliated to any political parties. And most of the people who've been trying to find them for so long, they are women. They are their relatives. And some of them, after 50 years, just in some cases die waiting for a last goodbye to their loved ones.
And what difference will this new commission make in the search for those who are still missing?
The most important part of this project is this led by the state, by the Chilean state. It will transcend the different governments. It will make a coordinated effort to search for the missing ones. It will allow financial resources to try to find some remains, but it represents a chance to say to these families who haven't found the remains of their loved ones that Chile, in a way, takes responsibility for them, that this is not a private drama, that this was part of a national tragedy, and that the whole state will collaborate with their efforts. In a way, I think this state-led effort tells all these relatives that they are not alone, that they will have the support of the rest of the country. And I think that's very important in symbolical terms and also in practical terms. It gives them a chance to find the remains of those who disappeared.
Paula Molina. To Indonesia now, where authorities are looking to get to the bottom of an online love scam. Dozens of Chinese nationals have been arrested, suspected of blackmailing their fellow countrymen and trying to extract their cash. They were operating from Batam Island near Singapore, and they could soon be kicked out of Indonesia and sent back to China. I spoke to BBC Indonesia's Trisha Dantiani in Jakarta and asked her to explain how the scam worked.
These Chinese people, they're all in this apartment complex in Batam, and they have Chinese women with them who they use to basically exploit callers on video call, basically pretend to be interested in them and get them to go into a video call where the victims would perform sexual acts on the video call, and this video call would be recorded. And that video would then be used as blackmail material to extort money from them. Because if they don't send them money, they would distribute the video on social media, basically. And that's how they keep getting this revenue stream from these victims who don't want that video to go out.
And how did the police uncover this syndicate?
They received a tip from the Ministry of Public Security in China, who have been getting reports and indications that there's this love scam going on in China, that a lot of people in China have been getting their money extorted, blackmailed by these mysterious scammers who they don't know where they are. But there's an indication that they are located somewhere in Indonesia. So they contacted the Indonesian police force, who basically tracked them down to this specific location in Batam, the Riau Islands province. And they located this syndicate inside this industrial park complex. And that's where they've been operating the scheme.
And some of the people who were allegedly blackmailed include some quite high-profile people back in China.
Yes, yes. According to the police, there are even public officials and business people and so on and so forth. That's how they could get as much as 10,000 yuan through this scheme.
And what do we anticipate happens now? Will these Chinese nationals be extradited back to China?
Yes, because they found no indication that there are any Indonesian people who were scammed. They've reached an agreement with the Chinese police to deport them back to China in parts and portions. So that's going to be the next step.
Tricia Dantiani in Jakarta. To Kenya now, where healthcare professionals are concerned that the country faces a real shortage of free condoms. Despite a demand for at least 400 million condoms annually, the government is only able to distribute some 150 million, leaving a significant shortfall. The AIDS Healthcare Foundation, a global non-profit organisation, has warned that if the shortage is not addressed, Kenya could face a preventable spread of sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV and unplanned pregnancies. My colleague, James Copnor, spoke to the BBC's Dorcas Wangira and asked her why there's a shortage.
There are two main reasons. One is the shrinking donor funding. You have donors like the Global Fund, USAID through PEPFAR, having cutbacks for Kenya, not just Kenya and other African countries. And then the other issue is because of tax. Well, condoms are considered medical devices, not medical supplies. So that means there's a 16% added tax, and that makes it more expensive to import.
And when I said earlier there's concern about healthcare professionals, how widespread is it? What are people suggesting?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is before, in previous years, particularly before the pandemic, you could walk into a public space like a health facility, a hotel, a restaurant, and you'd find dispensers with condoms. Now, the scenario is not the same. And the concern is for the vulnerable populations, people who cannot afford the condoms being sold in shops. And the concern is that this could threaten the gains made in the fight against HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, and also for people who use condoms as a family planning method.
And when we talk, for example, about the fight against HIV, the gains have been quite significant in Kenya over recent years.
Yes, yes, they have. And yesterday, there in a meeting being held in Mombasa, the coastal city, Kenya has had a significant reduction in HIV cases. In Africa, we still rank 7th with 1.4 million people living with HIV. And this is partly because of the supply of free condoms and other interventions. So the gains could be threatened because of this.
And when you said vulnerable people would struggle to afford condoms or do struggle to afford the ones you have to pay for, are we talking about quite a large percentage of the population? I mean, how expensive are condoms in Kenya?
Well, so I won't name particular brands, but you'd find, let's say, the cheapest in stores would go for a pack for $1. That's a pack of three condoms. And then you have others that are as expensive as $4. And now with the increase in tax, you're seeing these prices going up. Well, I cannot really say a particular estimate of the population, but when you think of the rural poor and the urban poor, that's where the problem is. And I guess right now, that's why this concern has been there, not just now, even in previous years, but it has become worse after the pandemic.
So obviously, the things you've talked about are very potentially very serious for Kenya in terms of healthcare, and that obviously places a burden too on the state's resources and most of all on Kenya's people. Then I suppose it becomes a question of priorities. Why does so much of it have to come from foreign donors? Why is this something that the Kenyan government, for example, is not prioritizing?
And that's a very important question, because the debate right now has been on own resource mobilization. For a very long time, and not just Kenya, many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, you have HIV was not just like a country's problem, it was a global problem. And it's only, particularly after the pandemic, which was a tipping point for governments to realize that they have their own priorities. And also, I guess, even with different political dispensations coming in from the different donor countries, you're seeing this change and you're seeing this shift. But it is definitely something that ministries and here in Kenya, the government has to prioritize.
Dorcas Wangira. It's a year and a half since Vladimir Putin launched his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Since then, there have been big changes inside Russia. New Western sanctions have been applied, prominent opposition activists have been arrested, and independent media silenced. It's getting increasingly difficult now to find out what ordinary Russians think and what's really going on inside the country. The BBC's Will Vernon has been travelling around Moscow, gauging the mood amongst people there.
I'm at the Victory Museum in Moscow. It's a sprawling complex of monuments and exhibitions. And in front of me, the square is covered in an enormous Russian flag, apparently the largest in the country, held high by lines of Russian soldiers. This is the kind of patriotic event the Kremlin is actively encouraging here. The message? The country is united behind the president and his special military operation, even as Ukrainian forces make progress in their counteroffensive.
Actually, that's patriotism. You can only rely on yourself, on your country, on your government, on your army.
Andrei Afanasyev is a pro-Kremlin blogger and university lecturer.
War mobilizes us and unites us. And I'm pretty sure that our strategy now is just wait till Ukrainian army and Ukrainian society is totally exhausted. We are ready for that. We are ready for victory.
But victory, whatever form that takes, seems a long way off for Russia. This conflict was meant to last a few days or weeks. But a year and a half on, and after tens of thousands of casualties, Russia is losing territory. And drone attacks on Moscow are now an almost daily occurrence. I'm driving through Moscow and I'm on the large six-lane highway that circles the city centre. But if I just put on my sat-nav, it goes completely haywire. The little dot that's meant to show my location is jumping all over the place. And it's telling me I'm in a completely different part of the city. Why is this happening? It's most likely the authorities are trying to scramble the signal of drones attacking Moscow, causing a lot of inconvenience to ordinary Russians. I've got to my destination now. I'm in Gorky Park, which is a bit like Moscow's version of London's Hyde Park, and there are people strolling along the embankment. But if I look just across from the park, I can see the imposing grey edifice of the Russian Ministry of Defence building. And just on top of it is a Russian air defence system, with its tubes pointed at the sky, some sort of radar at the top of it slowly rotating, scanning the skies of Moscow for any potential threats. Now, this is to protect the defence ministry against drones and anything else unexpected. So I want to see what people think about that and about the situation in general.
The air defence system doesn't bother me. Let them put a nuclear missile there if they'll feel better about it. I approve of what is happening. We need to annex all of Ukraine.
I feel safety, but sometimes, of course, I feel worrying about future and about our town. I hope that our country will more freedom and the war will be stopped.
Many Russians don't want to talk about what their country is doing in towns and cities in nearby Ukraine. But travelling around Moscow and talking to people, you don't get the impression that this country has been infected with war fever. Very few people are wearing T-shirts or clothing with pro-war symbols on them. But what there is a lot of indifference, resignation, or even quiet acceptance.
Will Vernon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Darcy O'Brie, and the producer was Beth Timmins. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.